Chair Clarino, members of the committee, I'm on page 12, talking about, from a very high-level view, the various programs that we're responsible for. And Representative Butler asked a question about the Benefits Equalization Fund, and is it part of the retirement agency, and does it true up from a fiduciary point of view from the board? I think that probably is clearer in the illustration at page 12. Going from left to right, we have the pension fund per se, and it has responsibilities for funding traditional retirement, but also disability retirement and death, and the complications that arise in the case of divorce. It also is the package of money that funds the $60 per month health insurance premium that's provided by statute in the health insurance side. The long-term disability part, which is also part of the health insurance services, does not have a subsidy of its own. The Benefit Equalization Fund is a separable program. Our work in Social Security is separable. And the Deferred Compensation Fund, which is also its own trust fund, which you probably know as the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, it has both state agency as well as a local government aspect to it. Because both state agencies as well as local governments can participate, and we'll talk about in a few moments about the growth of that plan. On page 13, to give you an idea of the size and scope of the plan, we talked about member counseling earlier. We talked about general service and police and firefighter retirements, disability, and death. The number of what we call active and inactive members, but pre-retirement members, is now over 200,000. And we maintain member accounts for all of them. Even if somebody works for 5 or 6 years in the public service and has been out of the public service for another 10, we may still have their account. In fact, over time, inactives are leaving their money with PERS more and more, so that we have a large body of accounts that we keep and we credit earnings to each and every year, even though they are no longer working in the public service.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
On that point, in the legislature, at least, and I don't know how it is through other branches, you vest after 5 or 6 years. So you're maintaining accounts for vested retirees. Do you maintain for pre-vested retirees also? Somebody that works 1 year or 6 months?
We certainly do for vested, Chair Clarino, Representative Hayden. We also keep an account for those who have not yet vested, on the first of all, it's their right, and second of all, on the possible anticipation that they would rejoin public service.
Thank you very much.
Again, in terms of scale, those 202,000 non-retired members as a whole contribute about $385 million per year in contributions. Remember, by statute, that's fixed at 6%. On page 14, you can get a sense of the rate of growth of a number of our key statistics. I think that a couple of points I'd make about this as you look, this is a relatively short period from 1995 to 2000. But in that period of time, the Public Employees Retirement System of Oregon has become the biggest financial service organization in the state of Oregon, as far as we know. I mean, in fact, we're not sure that anything even comes close. Benefit payments, in terms of the aggregate of money that we send out, has gone up by more than 100% just since 1995. Part of this was the resetting of benefit levels because of House Bill 3349, and part of it is just plain organic growth of benefits because of the success that we've had in investing members and employers' money, and also the growing size of the system and its membership. We looked at the recent census for Oregon and concluded that about 1 out of every 10 Oregonians has some financial relationship with the Public Employees Retirement System. And when you net out what we take in contributions from members and employers, we are putting back, the system has now matured to the point of view where we're putting back well over $500 million a year back into the Oregon economy. So if the Public Employees Retirement System were to disappear tomorrow, it would probably have a bigger effect on the income in the state of Oregon than most other things I can think of. The growth in membership, interestingly enough, is actually almost certain to accelerate soon. And the reason for that is, as I'll show you later, we are facing the baby boomers retiring. And, of course, as they retire, there are replacement hires that go in underneath them. When they retire, we don't lose them as a member. They just change their name from active to retiree, and we continue to keep an account for them, and we continue to issue them benefit checks. But there, we also gain an account because of the worker that's hired to replace them. And then on top of that, if there's any organic growth in government, beyond that, that's going to increase the growth rate as well. So we're thinking that over the next 15 years, we're going to see a substantial spike in membership and therefore the number of accounts that we have to keep track of. Just looking at the past 5 years, there's been almost a 50,000 member increase or account increase in the accounts that the agency has to keep track of, and that's in a 5-year period. That's really extraordinary growth.
And may I ask a question rather than coming back to it later? In line with that, I'm puzzled by the fact that although PERS has been here for a long time, members retire fairly early, life expectancies are long, I would anticipate you would have an equal number of retired members and workers, and yet you only have 82,000 retired members.
I think that Chairman Clarino, Representative Hayden, part of that is that a retirement system has different ratios at different points in its life cycle. And we could go back and show you, part of it depends on deaths, part of it depends on growth rates in public employment relative to the size of the system. We're a maturing system from a financial point of view, but we've only been in place since 1946. There are many pension plans in the country that are much older than us. So the question you ask is actually quite complicated, but it will change even over time because the baby boomers, we have a demographic bulge here in terms of a package of people roughly the same age that has nothing to do with the system itself, has everything to do with birth rates in the country as a whole. So the demographics that we see in the retirement system are partly a function of public employment trends and early retirement and other things, and partly a reflection of the same demographics that you see everywhere in the country. The next level of answer to that question is to probably go do some statistics for you, which we'd be happy to do if you like.
Probably, I guess it's, Madam Chair, I guess it's too complex for right now, and it's not a burning issue, so on you. Thank you.
Thank you. So those are the points that I wanted to make on page 14, and I'm prepared to move on to 15 if that is your pleasure. On the retired side, as Representative Hayden mentioned, we have 81,000 retired members, and it is correct that they are living longer, which, by the way, is another reason to think that our membership growth is actually going to... this is good news for people and humanity in general. It's usually bad news for the financials of a pension system. In fact, the longer lifespan of retired members or people about to retire is one of the issues that is vexing us in terms of our actuarial studies right now, whether we have properly incorporated that. It was an issue raised in the actuarial audit that Chairman Holman and his fellow board members initiated this year, and so this is something that we're likely to do considerably more work on in the future. The actuarial auditors indicated that there were a number of plans around the country who, looking at the advances in medical science, were saying that financially, I think that they're recommending that we need to think about extending out the period of time that we're going to have to be making payments to people, which again, for all of us, is good news from an individual point of view. We have about just under 850 employers. The employer rate is generally higher than 6%, although that's not true for all employers. And so the amount of contributions that we're receiving for employers exceeds the $385 million from members that I showed you earlier. It's just a little over $500 million annually. And when you sum up where we are in terms of the total trust fund assets, we're at $42 billion. And somebody, and I have not actually looked at this list myself, but there are a number of trade associations that keep track of the size of pension plans, and I'm told that Oregon ranked on one of these lists as 42nd largest in the globe, which is an awfully strong statement given that we're a relatively small state from the point of view of population, but we're a very highly concentrated plan, if you will. I will say that with my other hat, in terms of a member of the Oregon Investment Council, we recently had a retreat to plan the capability of OIC to deploy these funds into actual investments. And the planning assumptions that we had showed the plan having to invest somewhere between $65 and $80 billion, perhaps in that general range, in 10 years or less. And that's only if we just meet our actuarial assumption of 8% growth. So I think that for those of you who will be active in the public service 10 years from now, you'll be looking at a trust fund that will be even more eye-popping in terms of its size than you do today.
Representative Butler.
Just one question as I examine from page 13, the member contribution annually, which is 6% fixed. And then looking on page 15, the 841 employers putting in $510 million employer contributions, that's a third more. That $125 million represents, on $385 million, represents a third more. Number one, is there anyone that's under 6%? And number two, how are the local agencies, the 841 employers, and I assume 840 of those are non-state of Oregon, and the other municipal employers? How are they shouldering up to the 32.5%? Maybe Emil could address that, coming from a county where probably you're paying in excess of 6%. Number one, are there anyone less than 6%?
No. Not allowed.
Not allowed. So they're all 6% or greater. The state of Oregon, at the 841st, I guess, is at 6%, is it not?
No, it's actually higher than that. It's
9.23 or that range.
It's in excess of 9%. Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, the 6% that Chairman Holman referred to is a board policy because of the emergence of money match. It was a policy decision to ensure that while the system in essence shifted actuarially from one type of methodology much more toward another that was based on money match, that the board desired for the intervening time to make sure that the employer was putting in at least as much as their employees were. If we go to pooling, there's going to be an opportunity for those employers who actually, from a strict actuarial point of view, might be the appropriate rate might be 5 or 5.5 to go to that rate. But for the present time, in absence of pooling, the board's judgment was that a 6% floor was a prudent and wise thing to do. With respect to how local governments, and by the way, I might say that there are two large pools, Representative Butler, the state agencies, education, and then a disparate collection, not pooled at present time, of hundreds of local employers that can range in size from employment from 2 or 3 employees to as many as several thousand in the case of Multnomah County or Oregon or City of Portland. As to how those individual employers are holding up under the budgetary pressure of PERS rates that are higher than 6%, and many of them are higher than 6%, that's something that the staff is not expert in, and PERS really has nothing to offer of intelligence on the subject of the budgetary consequences at the lower level, although we happen to have a chairman who's a county commissioner who sees it from both ends. So if he would like to talk about how local communities are facing the PERS expense.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that is a driving problem for local governments. Umatilla County, as an example, the latest valuation, 1999, is they've been assessed an employer rate of 11.29%, which is pretty amazing for a relatively small employer. We have about 380 people working for Umatilla County, and we're paying, in many cases, the 6% employee contribution in addition to the rate that's been established by the PERS Board of Trustees. And we're looking at 17%+ of the payroll as an annual cost to provide the retirement system. We realize that's huge, and it's very difficult at times in hard times to address that in a way that makes a lot of sense, because it's seem to get skewed a little bit. We've been affected by House Bill 3349, which was about 1.26 of our rate. Had that been handled in some other way, those costs could have been covered by the state, for example, that would have been really beneficial for local players. So it's a continuing problem for us, but we see value in having the retirement system as a tool to attract a workforce in Umatilla County, because our compensation package really is not competitive, and by adding a retirement system and a benefit package, we're getting close to being competitive with other private sector and public sector agencies in our area.
Can I just ask, Madam Chair, relative, again, back to page 13, the $385 million of member contributions annually is fixed at 6%. If I calculate that correctly, that's using the $385 million, that's $6.4 billion in compensation of the members, which is a phenomenal. I'm not sure how much that represents in terms of Oregon's overall employer base, but that's got to be a pretty healthy amount. But coming back to the issue of the 11.29 at Umatilla, what's the maximum and the minimum? The minimum would be no one's paying less than 6%. What's the maximum that anyone is paying of the 841 employers there?
There are a handful of very small employers who have had that were unpooled and have had adverse circumstances, like a disability in a group of two or three or four. And so there are a few small employers that are seeing rates in the 41% is the highest. But that's highly unusual, but you would find at least a handful above 20%.
And are those people current with their obligations?
When by current, if you mean do they have unfunded actuarial liability that they are paying off, the answer is no, they're not current in that sense. Are they making sure that they make the actuarial payments that reflect working off that unfunded actuarial liability? We believe they are current. In essence, Representative Butler, having unfunded liability is kind of like having a loan out from the system that you've got to pay back over time. So that one of the reasons for their high rates, in fact, the reason for their high rate, is not just to provide the benefits to their current employees, but to work off, in essence, an unfunded liability that has that they've generated over time.
So the potential is, Madam Chair, the potential is that if that was, if that particular unit had a substantial unfunded actuarial liability and they were paying 41, and their employees had bargained to have both the employer and the employee's share paid by the employer, you could be approaching 50% of the actual payroll obligation being paid in to just the public employee retirement system of the state.
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, in this particular instance, which is a rare one, that is true. What isn't rare is the 6% pickup. That's not universal, but it's more widespread than 41% rates. So adding the 6%, certainly you will encounter far more often than a PERS rate of 41%. We can actually give the committee a distribution of rates that shows how many of them, say, for example, are paying PERS rates above 20%.
I think because, Madam Chair, because we deal with a lot of, I mean, everybody that we represent in our local districts, whether it's counties or cities or water districts or irrigation districts, road districts, those kinds of things, I think it would be important that we know where our constituents fall within those various categories, and I think I would like to go ahead and request that information.
We'll be happy to provide.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the question of the administrator at this time. Would some of those employees also, if they're in high-risk jobs, be paying workers' comp rates at that level or in excess?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, member of the committee. I'm not exactly sure of what the rates are in workers' comp, but the answer is the higher risk jobs, the higher the workers' comp rate. And I'm not sure if governments pool, much like we pool for PERS. I'm not sure that we're able to do that.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, as I remember from my time on the Labor Committee, many worker comp rates exceed 40%. Some used to be up to 120 before reform. So maybe we could probably be doubling, you know, the retirement benefits plus the workers' comp.
You would be doubling if it was the unfunded actuarial liability was as a result of disability that was job-related. It's entirely conceivable that for every dollar paid out between the PERS and labor in a small group between the PERS assessment and the workers' compensation assessment could be matching that dollar somewhere else. So it's a big expense to our local government.
Sure.
And I know that Chair Holman is feeling it in Umatilla
County. Absolutely.
Much as we are throughout District 60 and the counties there.
The counties that are have a long, long time now that they've been having tough economic times must have a real burden. Okay, if you'd continue.
Page 16, if I could, go on to the next program, which is our health insurance services. We have, I believe, less than 2 FTE directed at this program. It provides coverage for quite a few thousand retirees to give them additional health insurance coverage that we negotiate for them under contract. It's extremely popular. An increasingly higher percentage of people opting for retirement are also opting for the Public Employees Retirement System program for health insurance post-retirement. And we think that this program is also going to grow over time. We're holding the line in terms of the services, in terms of the staff that we throw at this program, because really of what's on the next page, page 17, is that we are using a third-party administrator, Best Choice currently that's located in Portland, to do much of the work involved in both dealing with the individual retirees that have questions, and they have a huge number of questions regarding their insurance coverage under the various contracts that we've negotiated for them, umbrella contracts. The third-party administrator has relieved us of a tremendous staffing burden. In addition, we use some consultants that assist us in negotiating the contracts, which come up periodically so that we don't have to have expert individuals on staff at all times when we only renegotiate those contracts every couple of years. We've just added long-term care insurance coverage, again, using the third-party model with Unum Insurance, and that has also proved to generate a lot of interest on the part of retirees in terms of our ability to buy in bulk, in essence, and deliver to our retirees in things that they could not negotiate individually. Page 18, moving on to the next program, which is the Oregon Savings Growth Program. Also, a program that's separate but related to the basic pension program. The Oregon Savings Growth Program is a pre-tax deferral savings plan that's built on the model that's used widely throughout the United States, increasingly so, which is very much a public sector version of 401k. And we have a tremendous penetration now of state employees. That's where it started. We're approaching $750 million in trust in total assets. Again, we're using the third-party administrator model here. In this case, we use City Street Bank for a wide variety of services, including, in this case, record keeping. And that has proved to be pretty successful. We had to work at it for the first couple of years in order to get it to work right, but it has become quite a popular program. And we think we'll have about 3,000 new participants joining the program at the current rate over the next several years. On page 19, you can get a sense of the growth of the program. It's been pretty rapid. And this is just the state government part of it, the state employees. It's really quite phenomenal, I think, just reflecting on it, that a group of employees that has what their stakeholder groups themselves tell us is a very good retirement program, also opting to put additional savings from their check into an additional plan. I don't know where the national savings rate calculations come from, but they certainly don't seem to come from Oregon, because it seems to be a state of savers. We are in the process of moving on with this program and making it available to local governments. And it, again, we've seen a lot of interest. So far, we've had 63 local public employers join, and that's in just under 3 years, which is, I think, a pretty substantial sign-up rate, considering that we've only had one person really talking to these individual employers and talking to them about the program. We're not out selling. We have the program, and if they want to join, usually there's a tremendous amount of information demand they have on the front end before they go to their governing body and their employees, I should say. Again, for this part of the program, just like with the state part, we use a third-party administrator in the case of City Street Bank, which allows us to just have a few employees managing the administration of the program, although we'll talk a little bit about some of the work we do in terms of member counseling in this area. We think, by the way, that we'll have some of the largest local public employers in the state of Washington joining this plan over the next 3 years, and we could see it easily exceed $1 billion the next time our budget comes up. Savings seems to be very popular.
Johnson?
I know you want to hold questions till the end, but I'm just lost. And
okay.
If you'll tolerate a completely freshman question, and it'll show my appalling lack of knowledge of this program. You have, for the last few points that you've made in your presentation, continued to detail additional programs that you're offering. And you just said that you don't have someone out selling, but there are all these questions that are being asked by potential enrollees in your health insurance services. I'm trying to figure out what's the basic PERS contract, the contract that you have with those retirees and people in the system who have the expectation of participating in the PERS system, versus programs that you may have for one reason or another added. And then the subset to that is, for the programs that you're adding, are they profit centers in and of themselves, or are they being subsidized in some way by the entire program?
Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, first of all, that's not a freshman question. That cuts to the heart of what we're about. First of all, we don't add these programs, by and large. Usually they're statutory creations. Second of all, the contract that a participant would have with the public employees retirement system depends on which program they're participating in. So, for example, a retiree who's participating in our health insurance program has a contract, if you will, and I use the term in the small C sense, with the public employees retirement system that relates to our provision of this contracted service to them. And so in that case, many of the obligations to the retiree really come from the people we've written a contract with the health care provider. But that's different in the case of the retirement system itself, where the contract is really with the trust fund and with the trustees, which includes the board and the staff who have fiduciary responsibilities. So that's where the contract comes from. With respect to cross subsidies, we try very hard not to do that, because these are individual trust funds that stand on their own merits. So it would be inappropriate to use one set of assets that we hold in trust for one program and one set of participants with which we have a contract for other purposes. So you notice that on some of the displays that I've had, we make sure we identify those programs that are actually trusts, and we keep a separate set of books on those, and we try very hard. Now, there are some expenses, like myself and a handful of senior staffers, we work across all of those programs. We don't actually keep time cards. These responsibilities cut across programs, but we do try to be extremely careful not to take monies from one trust and apply them to activities in another area.
Is there a mechanism as you are adding what now I understand to be statutorily proscribed additional services? Is there a mechanism to ask for fee for service within those programs? For example, you've made reference a couple of times to some pretty expanded counseling that you need to do. Is there an opportunity to go back to the beneficiaries and say, this is costing the program money, we'd like you to pay for this?
Chair Clarno, Representative Johnson, you've just said my favorite phrase, fee for service, because we consider ourselves a gigantic fee for service agency. We don't really get other funds from any other place. We only get funds from our participants, and we only provide service to our participants. We're a totally closed loop, fee for service. That's at the general conceptual level. But we even drive that down a little further. For example, the Oregon Savings Growth Program, which I've just described, there is a small fee just taken off the top of the assets, if you will, that we use to pay for the activities surrounding this program, so that we don't have the issue of going into the PERS, the Public Employee Retirement Systems Trust Fund, to try to get money to pay for this. Now, have we driven it down to the next level in which we charge a fee for people who walk in for counseling? By and large, we have not done that at this point. We're open to good ideas if that makes sense.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a good segue, I think, from Representative Johnson. Last session, we worked with Steve Delaney from your staff on some issues relative to other folks joining in on the PERS by making contributions for service that they may have performed in other states. For instance, professors going on lecturing tours abroad and those kinds of things could return and make contributions for the years that they may have been absent. And this, I think we use this as a potential way to also enhance our teaching pool within our university system as well. And at that time, we said as long as there was no cost to the system, and all of these were based upon no cost to the system, you must have fairly good cost information relative to each section at that point as to absolutely what each particular trust and each particular service is costing the PERS system. Is that correct? Can we have access to it?
Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, the answer, first of all, there's two costs to the system, and I think the phrase that you hear, no cost to the system, is really an actuarial term. That is, if somebody wants to buy credit toward a future benefit in the system has to be financially held harmless by the transaction. That's really what we mean by, you know, no cost to the system. When you hear that phrase, it's generally what we mean. However, there's another cost, which is administrative cost, and by and large, I don't think that that's necessarily true. We have not, for example, charged fees for more complex transactions that require more staff time and administrative effort. And it's one of the issues on the table because, as I said before, we're rated by outside benchmarking groups as having one of the most complex systems. And as you referenced earlier, there are a number of stakeholder groups, whether it's university educators, high school teachers and elementary school teachers, police and fire, who would love to have our system opened up and made more accessible to people that they'd like to recruit from out of state. Yes, we try to make sure that actuarially those transactions are neutral. Are they neutral from an administrative expense point of view? I think probably not.
Clarification, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative
Butler. I think that we tried to address not just the actuarial side of it, but we also tried to address the administrative side as well on some of the issues in last session. Did we accomplish that or did we fail? I'm now perplexed because we wanted the administrative not to suffer as well.
Well, we Chair Clarno, Representative Butler, I'm going to turn to the staff, and if we do not charge an administrative fee for these special transactions, then almost by definition, we're not encompassing. Do we charge a fee?
We do not charge an administrative fee, and we discussed.
Come on up, please, and identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me. For the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at PERS. You're right, Representative Butler, that we talked about making sure there was a full cost purchase that was being made and that person paid the full cost. What was never clear in the legislation was if the individual was to pay, for instance, the fee to come in and talk to a PERS counselor and pay for the cost of an estimate to be run off the system. I know it was discussed, but it never came out in the final bills. It was never given clear direction on that, something we'd be open to.
Madam Chair, it was absolutely my understanding that there was no cost at any level, not just the actuarial cost, but anyone that was asking us any favors of because we do expend a great deal of time and effort and energy to, as you can see in the presentation, to assist to make sure that the right benefit is going to the right person and the right amount. And it was my understanding that any of the new additions, as far as I'm concerned, we could go back and address all of the existing programs that to the extent that folks use these kinds of add-ons, that administratively there should be a charge. I am charged on an annual basis for my administration just to accept my check into my own retirement account at the brokerage house. They, you know, and then they collect a fee to invest that into some XYZ fund, whatever. It's usually the sinking six fund, I think. Sinking six C's or something, I think. Gives me a sinking feeling every time I see it, too. But they charge the administrative fee annually, and then they charge a fee when they invest. And it was my understanding that we were going to try and make the PERS system as much as a pay-as-you-go system as we possibly could, including annual administration fees. That's where I came from. Excuse me.
Oh, Senator Dukes and then Representative Hayden.
Well, I would be disappointed if the day comes when we are charging people to begin their retirement planning, because I think you're going to find some people who won't then take advantage of the planning that they should be doing before they retire. And since I recently discovered that planning is only advisory and we can't count on it for any surety, I don't think it's something we ought to be charging for.
You don't even be talking to them yet.
But I have constituents.
Okay, all right.
I think that there are some things that a system provides, and the entire system pays for that, and retirement counseling, I think, is one of those things. Other fees, there probably is good merit for.
Yeah.
But that's
the add-ons that I'm concerned about.
Oh, yeah, and those definitely. Mm-hmm. But I just hope we never get to the day where, in order to go take the course or the seminar or whatever it is, or to go in and visit with a counselor about your retirement, that you have to pay a fee.
Representative Hayden.
Well, continuing that thought, Madam Chair, yes, the private pension funds that I participate in do charge an administrative fee, a small one, 1% or something. As Representative Butler says, if they did not charge that 1% fee, then they would have to provide their services out of the earnings of my pension plan, which would reduce the future benefits to me. So there's a trade-off there. But we have, in view of the large number of requests they have, some of them doubtless frivolous and some of them repetitive. I don't think I've ever phoned them myself, even though I am a first retiree. But I understand from the discussion that many people do. Now, in the health field, in order to reduce a little of that, we charge a very small copay by mandate in very many cases. Very small copay, $5 to go to the doctor. It means that you won't go to the, even the small copay means that you won't call the doctor unless you think you need him. Maybe a small copay, maybe a small fee, not enough to disenfranchise those that need the help, but enough to discourage the repetitive, frivolous things.
Did you have a question, Representative Johnson?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
If I could, Chair Kleiner, if I could just make sure that everyone understands, we do, the system and its participants do pay for the administration. We're just not at the level where we're actually charging per transaction or event. Okay. I'm going to skip by page 21 in the work that we do on Social Security, because I think it's more important to get to page 22 with some of the major budgetary issues.
And I appreciate that, because we've got about, Senator Dukes and I have session at 10:45 this morning. So we'll need to go about 10 or 12 more minutes.
Well, that's perfect, because I think the next five slides are the most important.
Okay.
Chair Holman and I have discussed the retirement of the baby boomers and the fact that our membership growth over the next 15 years is likely to be very high with what with replacement workers as well. We've talked a little bit about the changes that have gone on in the Internal Revenue Code, the legislature itself. PERS board has been very active in rulemaking to accommodate the shift in the system toward the money match rules and toward our commitment to codify rules and practices much more formally than we have in the past. We have a serious problem in our aging information system. It's a major impediment to what we do. We have spent money on the information management system, but only to add new programs on top of it to accommodate legislative and programmatic changes. We have about 1,000 of those programs that have been layered in cake-like fashion, one on top of another. We have not actually spent a dollar that I'm aware of, and I asked the staff this the other day, since 1988 on the system itself in terms of its infrastructure and capabilities. We have a major deferred capital expense there, which is one of the reasons why we're asking Chairman Hill's committee for so much money, because the task is large.
How much money are you asking for?
We've spent $13 million over the past 2 years to do careful risk reduction and design of the system. We're literally at the point where we're ready to begin the build if the legislature authorizes us, and the build will cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million. There's some additional money also in our regular budget, which we can talk about tomorrow, associated with operating the pieces of the system as they come on board.
I don't understand what the words "the build" means.
To actually build the system.
Information technology system, and we'll discuss that later after Representative Jim Hill's committee has reviewed that. Okay, please go ahead.
The growth in the Oregon Savings Growth Plan we've talked about already, plus the retiree insurance. We also have, as Chairman Holman indicated, an enormous increase, like a 14-fold increase since the last budget in appeals and contested cases. We also are involved in major litigation brought by employers and employees with diametrically different points of view as to how the system ought to have been run and should be run in the future. Plus, as I say, the board has committed to codifying its rules and practices, and so we have a very large slate of rulemakings underway, which we'd be happy to give a list to the committee if you're interested in what we're working on at present. The last point that I'd mention,
Representative Butler would like that.
We'd be happy to.
I'd like some sense of what the scope of the litigation is. I noticed throughout the report it talks about increased litigation. You just touched on a subtlety of it, that it's employer and employee diametrically opposed. But is there some kind of a summary of the litigation? Are there big class actions? Are there?
They're not class actions in the technical sense, but they go to, I can tell you that they go to the heart of the policies that have been used at the Public Employees Retirement System for the last 20 years. And so they're quite fundamental, and we could have DOJ. DOJ periodically prepares a summary for us if the committee would like a high-level summary of the issues involved in the litigation.
I think we would, and the costs associated with them as well. Thank
yes,
you.
Sir.
Thank
you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dukes?
I have a time warp here. Last interim in the audits committee, you came before us and said that you were preparing for a new system, but didn't yet know if that new system was something that you would want to use. I mean, there was a certain, as bad as it was, there was a certain value in what you had. And then there was this new system that was being developed that may or may not be, because there were real risks in switching over. Has the board then, I guess I'm asking, formally voted to move to the new system?
I think the board has, if I may, Madam Chair and Senator Dukes, the board has given a great deal of thought to the value of being able to have a system that is going to not only better accord services to the people that we currently serve, but the oncoming rush of retirees that we see in the next 10 to 15 years. So realizing that it's a tremendously expensive process, we do need the necessary tools, I think, to accommodate the demands of the system. So I think the board, to answer your question in simple terms, yes, the board is very much in accord with management and have been very closely associated with the pre-planning that's occurred, the last $13 million that have been expended to come up with a program that we think is something that we really need.
And Chair McLaren, Senator Dukes, if I could say, in that testimony, which I can again supply you with the written version, what we said at that time was that we had not settled on a design yet, and we constantly compete the design against fixing rims. But fixing rims, the latest price tag was $127 million, and it wouldn't be as good as a modern system. And so we have gone past that point now. We've settled on a design, and we're working with LFO, IRMD, and the e-commerce committee to explain why we got to the point we did.
Thank you. I heard who you said you were working with. Are you also working with the Department of Administrative Services, their technology?
Yes, yes.
That's IRM. Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Butler.
You used up all the
rest. Very expensive, Representative. That was my first slip.
LFO, IRMD.
Yeah. You might want to bring some more money.
I think I better.
I'm just kidding.
The last point I'd like to make, Chair Farnell, on page 22 is something that is new. We don't have too many new things in this budget, but one of them is an investment in some expanded risk management. We're weak in the internal audit area, and let me give you a sense. We have one internal auditor. We did a survey of other plans. We know no plan of even remotely comparable size that only has one internal auditor. This just isn't prudent. Second is that I asked our internal auditor to produce the key risk areas that we would normally, from a management point of view, be auditing internally on a regular basis. And I have that list here. It's kind of messy. I just pulled it out of my briefcase. But I'll give you the bottom line. Of the 42 key risk areas, 28 have not been audited in the last 10 years. Now, as the executive director, I'm not happy with that. That doesn't make me feel good. And it makes me feel so bad, in fact, that I'm in front of you asking for some resources to add to the risk management area because I think it's the prudent thing to do. There's also an interaction here between our aging IT system and the audit needs. I'll give you a picture. Because of our need to make sure that people don't, on their own, issue checks or change people's accounts, but our system doesn't allow automatic checks on the work of individual people, we sometimes have to sit two staffers side by side down in front of the same screen, kind of like when they fire missiles in the silo. One person gets to issue the check or adjust the account or make a change in the database, and the other one makes sure that it's the one they're supposed to be doing. That's not very efficient. And the way to get around that is through an IT system that has a workflow that allows a supervisor to see all the changes that are being made in the database before they actually get affected. And that's what we have in our design. Page 23 gives you a picture, if you will, of that demographic bulge that we see in terms of, you can see that as we stand today, there's a group of people peaking around age 50. And that happens to be how old I am. And I happen to be one of the early baby boomers. And I'm thinking about retirement someday myself. And so that it's not surprising that that as we look ahead, we can see that big, we call this the mountain chart, heading toward us and triggering a lot of retirements and a lot of replacement workers, and therefore the sum of the two being an increase in our number of accounts. If you look at page 24, you can see that we actually experienced in 98 and 99 an explosion, absolute explosion of retirements. So much so that, in fact, we borrowed ahead, and we've had retirements actually decline somewhat this year. But you can see that the trend line, if you draw a line through those, is pretty much along the lines that we anticipate. The increases that we saw in 98 and 99 were largely the result of some of the programmatic, you know, cliffs, if you will, and that we've made some changes in the program that allows people not to have to confront the retirement decision with such, you know, binary black or white consequences. But we wouldn't be surprised to see over the next 3 to 5 years, you know, up and down, but basically along the lines that you see here, because that's reflecting how old the people are that are working in the public sector right now. Page 25 gives you a quick summary of some of the things we've faced over the past number of years. as well as some of the things that are currently on the table today. We talked about the Internal Revenue Code 415 and the Benefit Equalization Fund, but we also have things like after-tax recovery, where people have brought in after-tax contributions into the system. Therefore, when those benefits have to be paid out, they're treated differently than benefits that have grown from pre-tax contributions to the plan. The IRS requires that. It's much more complicated bookkeeping. And in the state legislative arena, I think you know what the history has been. It's been pretty active up until the last session. But there's, I don't know how many, an estimate, Mr. Delaney, of the number of PERS-related bills that are currently before the legislature, rough?
50.
That we're tracking at the present time, so it could be a very active period for us in terms of changes. The other thing I mentioned earlier that there are times when we have to do work twice. House Bill 3349 was a classic case in the sense that we had to go back in time and redo the accounts and annual crediting and retirement calculations for thousands and thousands of individuals. We have a similar situation with the Young case in front of us. Fortunately, the estimates of the number of people that we might have to do recalculations on is a lot lower than it was, but it still could easily reach 2,000. That's 2,000, in essence, transactions that we have to go back and redo either their basic account year by year, recalculating the amount of earnings that they would have earned, should have earned, and also for those that have retired, we have to recalculate their whole retirement package. I might say on page 26, to go into a little more detail about our problems with our information management system, I don't want to cry wolf here. The sky is not falling. The benefit checks will go out. But this system is at the end of its useful life. It's written in a computer language that nobody is building systems in anymore. It's highly inflexible and quite rigid in its original design, severely limiting our ability to, for example, institute Tier 2, or the contemplated, at least by some members, Tier 3, or any other programmatic changes that might come down the road. It's also extremely expensive to maintain. We have two budget areas that have been particularly problematic. One is the litigation rulemaking appeals expense that has raised our Department of Justice bill substantially. The other one is Department of Administrative Services data center charges, and we're not sure what's driving those because we don't really have a contract with the data center, so we don't really know. We don't get units of usage. We don't get price lists. We don't have a contract. We don't have performance standards. There's no accounting for past overcharges that we've had. What we want to do as we put in the new information management system is to basically establish the same relationship with the data center that we have with DOJ, that we have with our actuaries, that we have with our third-party administrators, and that is a contract that says, you know, they agree to do certain things, we agree to give them business, there's a certain price list, there's a certain set of performance standards that have to be met. If they're not met well, we need to be able to look elsewhere. It's the way a trust fund should do business with external parties. It's hard for somebody outside the agency to really get a sense of how much our system holds us back. Let me just give you one sense because it's very recent. We have what's called the dark period. The dark period just ended on Friday, and we're pleased about it. The dark period starts at midnight on December 31st when we close our database. And we close it because our system is unable to generate effective transaction histories. So we can't put any new transactions in it if we're going to generate a year-end statement. So like a utility that generates spent fuel rods, we have to put them off to the side because we can't stop doing transactions. We have statutory requirements to get out benefit checks in a certain period of time. So we do those and we put them off to the side and we store them elsewhere until we can finally keep the database frozen until we can finally credit earnings and get statements out to members and employers, and then we turn around and dump all the new changes back in and go forward for the rest of the year. It's a terrible way to do business, but it's one of the basic flaws in the structure of our system that we hope to change.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to stop you there so we can get over to the Senate. You stopped on page, was it about 26 or 27?
About there.
And we'll start there again tomorrow. Anything further, Dallas?
No.
If not, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Tomorrow. Sorry to stop you so abruptly, but
no.
To get your bills and get back over the other side of the building.
We appreciate your time.
Yeah, probably hate me.
Find where you thought we'd be.